April 16th, 2015, I'm opening a public hearing on House Bill 5026, the Department of Human Services Policy Packages and the Governor's Budget. And I believe that up at the podium is Erin Kelly Seals, who is the Director of DHS. And with her, I see an old friend. That's Pam Curtis.
Thank you very much.
And
John Taponia with Echo Northwest.
Okay.
Good morning, co-chairs, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Erin Kelly Seal. Thank you, Senator Renners, for the introduction. I am the director of the Department of Human Services. I'm going to do a quick overview today, and you will be hearing from many different people. What we need to accomplish today for you is we need to give Pam and John some time to give you an update on the pay for prevention work that you already have funded, and then also talk about the investment that was in the governor's budget and what that would achieve. And from there, we will going into the other policy packages in the child welfare, vocational rehabilitation, intellectual and developmental disability services, and aging and people with disability programs. We took an approach to the request that we come do this presentation really mindful of the very difficult budget constraints that we're currently operating in, and that the co-chair's budget creates a different frame, a different funding level, a different kind of conversation about what actually can be afforded in terms of our budget. And we are just wanting to make sure that you know that we know those conversations are also happening, even though for the next couple of days you're going to be hearing from us about the investments that were made in the governor's budget. We will be talking with you about the dollars and the positions associated with those investments, what they are intended to accomplish, why they were prioritized in that budget, and then what some of the risks are or if they're not funded. And then we've been scheduled to do this for 2 days. Today we're trying to get through the agenda that's at the top, and that will be a very aggressive schedule. And Monday we will cover an additional couple of programs, self-sufficiency, shared and central services. Just for perspective, before we get into the Department of Human Services budget, I did want to make sure that you had a couple of things in mind as you talk about these investments. The governor, when he approached this budget last year, asked us to really approach the budget from a more bottom-up funding approach. In other words, taking the legislatively approved budget and then having a prioritized conversation about what would come next. We also did some comparison to what a current service level budget would finance, and ultimately we came in under just slightly where a current service level budget would have fallen. The biggest driver in the governor's budget and in the CSL budget is caseload for our budget increase. And in the end, the governor's ended up with a recommended budget that's 7% over where the LAB for 13-15 was in total fund dollars and cents. I wanted to let you know that the policy packages that you're going to be hearing about were prioritized by means of really self-funding. We took reductions in things like inflation. We took a risk or two on some TANF contingency funds. We had some savings in some caseload. That's really how any new work that's in the governor's budget was financed. Otherwise, the programs were held flat in many respects. And I know for the provider community and for those that we work with, that holding flat of inflation is a pretty big deal. So I just wanted to give that introduction as we are about to talk about lots of opportunity for investment, even though I know that we have a budget-constrained environment. And first, I'm going to turn it over to Pam to talk about what they've been doing with the Pay for Prevention project with the investment that you made in them this biennium.
Great. Thank you. Good morning. For the record, Pam Curtis with the Center for Evidence-Based Policy at Oregon Health and Science University. And with me,
John Taponia, President of Echo Northwest.
And we've been partnering in the Pay for Prevention project, which we want to speak with you about just very briefly today. So
do you want me to do that, or do you want to do it? I think it'll reach out.
All right, great. Thank you. So just as I know that many of you are familiar with this, but just as a word of background, and I should say that we've been asked to take about 10 minutes, so we're going to go through this at a fairly quick pace. We'd be more than happy to follow up with you on any individual questions that you have or to come back as we go deeper into some of the data that you're going to see today. So at its core, pay for prevention is essentially a financial model and a new way of delivering services for children and families, high-risk children and families. And on the financial model side, it essentially, for all intents and purposes, increases our ability to invest in stabilizing families and high-risk and the lives of high-risk young children by growing the amount of resources that are available to the state for preventative services through a public-private partnership that's based on the principles of social innovation financing. Some of you may know that as social impact bonds. The generic term that's used these days around the country is pay for success. And so we're doing that in Oregon. We've been working on developing an Oregon-specific model since 2009. And this fiscal year, you appropriated about $800,000 for us to do the final groundwork, or the ground laying, if you will, to implement and pilot test this model, both on the finance side and on the service delivery side. So you asked us specifically to do a couple of things related to that final ground laying. You asked us to evaluate, critically appraise and evaluate the evidence. You asked us to compile state data in a new way, which we have done and we'll talk about today. You asked us to create a specific model for using that data to create a specific predictive model to identify those children who are historically at highest risk and have high probability of entering the child welfare system but have not yet done so. And you asked us to develop an economic model for assessing return on investment in real Oregon dollars based on real Oregon programs and historical use of those programs, and to increase provider capacity for delivering this new service model. So that's a lot with $800,000 and a very quick time frame. So we are in process with all of these activities. John and I are going to give you a quick preview of the work that is in process. We have completed some of the activities. We're in process with the others. We will be done by the end of May with a very in-depth report and series of data to come back and show you if you'd like, or we can give you peeks as we go along. So very first, I'll start with the results of the evidence reviews. We have conducted three evidence reviews. Two are complete. One is nearly complete. The first evidence review looks at the risk factors for entry into child welfare and foster care. That evidence review is complete, and I'll show you just a quick scan of those findings in just a moment. The second evidence review is asked what are the outcomes, both short and long-term outcomes that are associated with entry into foster care for children and families. And then third, what are the programs or the specific interventions that are most effective at reducing those risk factors. So very briefly, here are some of the results of those evidence reviews. You can see specifically to each of the evidence reviews I indicated what we have done. Let me just say, in the interest of time, at a high level, that we have reviewed more than 3,000 articles. We have quality assessed those articles, and we have gone into the source documents for those articles. Suffice it to say that across all of three of the evidence reviews, we yielded about one and little over 1% of those 3,000 articles were high quality articles and using scientific methods. So we are just basing the work that we are doing on those A-plus quality articles, and I'd be happy to spend more time with you if you're interested in what those findings were. I'm going to turn it over to John briefly to talk about the data analysis piece.
And we'll move through this very quickly. So ECHO's charge again, two models using a remarkable amount of data. One is to predict maltreatment and foster care episodes, given what we know about family conditions. The second was to monetize the cost of investigations and foster care placement and adoptions, etc. The center has assembled in a very secure place under the review of the Institutional Review Board of the center a remarkable data set that I am unaware that exists anywhere else in the United States. It consists of birth records for every child that was born in the state of Oregon between the year 2001 and 2010. It includes, for those same children, every interaction with the Department of Human Services and Medicaid program. and every interaction that their parents had with the Department of Human Services and Medicaid program and the Department of Corrections. And it also includes every child care, foster care episode.
Just when I believe yes. that.
Oh, no, I'm just, okay. I'm just nodding in agreement. Okay. Sorry, Madam Chair.
So, unprecedented assembly of data that was no small effort to both get access to securely and then to match and organize, et cetera. So a sneak preview at some of the things that we have found. First of all, looking at those 2001 births. So I'm just stepping back a little bit and saying, let's take a look at all the children in the state of Oregon that were born in the year 2001. What share of them do we find touching the Department of Human Services or the Medicaid program by their first birthday? The answer was 43%. Now, if I roll forward for those same children and I say, all those children that were born in the year 2001, what share of them do I find having touched the Department of Human Services or Medicaid by their 13th birthday at some point in their life? The answer is 63%. Now, if I take those same children, the year 2001, and I only look at the children whose mothers did not graduate from high school, which is known on the birth record, and I say, what share of them by their 13th birthday have touched the Department of Human Services or the Medicaid program? The answer is 94%. So that is just the beginning of the kind of information that this kind of data is going to be able to provide. This is a chart that simply illustrates the same data that I conveyed, which is year by year, at the time of birth and into their early teens, what share of children with parents of different conditions are we finding on the Department of Human Services? But of course, this is a child maltreatment and foster care intervention, so we want to know more about that as well. What we have now are a few charts that are backward looking in terms of where do we see census tracts in the state of Oregon with unusually high disproportionate numbers of foster care episodes. This backward looking map is the kind of map that we're going to produce with predictive forward looking statistics. Where we're looking at the conditions of families and being able to look forward and predict geographically where we're expecting to see more episodes. And so what you can see here are a variety of different sized circles. The smaller circles are places where we see relatively few episodes, larger circles where you see higher concentrations. So you can see that if we're looking at all the foster care episodes for that time period of 2006 to 2014, they're spread broadly across the state of Oregon. But as we start to peel away and say, where are the hot spots, where are the high concentrations, you can sort of see as we click through. We'll take one away at a time here.
We got another, two away now.
Right. Move one more until we get to the sort of the, this piece here where we have identified census tracts in the state where you have unusually high concentrations. So, for example, you can see all up and down the Oregon coast. Coos Bay stands out relative to the rest of the coast. If you look in eastern Oregon, Ontario and Pendleton, more so than Baker City and LaGrande. So again, these are backward looking, but we have the data now in this database to start doing this in a forward looking and say what's going to happen in the next year, what's likely to happen in the next couple of years. So that's the predictive piece of this. And then finally, when we talk about economic modeling, what we have done is we have taken a look not only at those foster care episodes with respect to where they happen, but we're looking at the cost associated with a cohort's worth of abuse and neglect. This particular chart is taking abuse that took place in the year 2000. The first episode of abuse is in the year 2000, and how long do the costs persist for that cohort of children that were abused in the year 2000 for as long as we could follow them. And so what this is essentially showing is in that first year, because the children are being abused over the course of the year, the costs are truncated in that way because the abuse is happening. But then you have a peak in that second year, and you continue to have costs. Those are in millions of dollars for that entire population of children that were abused in that first year. You continue to see costs out in the 11th year, if we were to follow it further, you would have it tailing off into years 14, 15, 16, 17, 18. That information would then be used to inform the return on investment estimates. A lot of cooperation, both in terms of the data to collect that, but also the Department of Human Services budget analysts in helping us understand what drives costs. So,
great.
Yes.
Yeah, John, good information. It's actually somewhat disturbing, to be truthful with you. I mean, in the sources in which you've received and collected all this information. Representative Williamson and I are working on a bill right now that deals with the women in Department of Corrections right now that are under Measure 57. So I really see the connection. I'm interested in the one slide that you had for the 94% for the moms that did not graduate from high school. That's fascinating. Mm-hmm. So have you done any more closer up-to-date research on that measurement right there? Or I know you took that snapshot back in 2001, but do you have anything more current?
Representative Olson, co-chairs, we have births up to 2010. That was simply the limits at the time that the vital statistics could provide. And so certainly for the cohort of children born in 2010, we could replicate it. I would be shocked if the answer was much different. And that's not a trivial number of kids. Back in the year 2001, there were about 40,000 kids born in the year, maybe 42,000. 9,500 of them were born to mothers who did not hold a high school degree. So it's not a small number of kids that are in that status.
Okay, thanks.
Start.
Okay, thanks, Madam Chair. So I have two questions. One is that your stats and everything and all that, getting the information, did you have to get permission from the parents, or how did that work?
Co-chairs, Representative Boone, great question. The data that we are using and will continue to use to do further and deeper analysis, which we'll talk about in just a moment, is already existing data. It was de-identified, so the specific answer to your question is no, but we were able to use de-identified assigned numbers to do matching. So we were able to create and have a continuous picture of a cohort of children and their paths that they take through the Oregon systems that is unprecedented.
Okay, and then my second question is a follow-up to Representative Olson, and that is, of the mothers who didn't graduate and had these kids, were they still in school, or did you divide it down to still in school, or how far out of school, like were they 25 mm-hmm. or, you know, a few years
yeah.
out?
You're peeling the onion in real time. Some of those things are known, some of those are unknown. So we do know the age of the mother at the time, so we could speculate. And certainly those are other risk factors. Those that haven't graduated and had a child at age 16 have higher issues than those that are maybe 22 and didn't graduate at 22 at the time of birth. We are in conversations and favorable conversations with the Department of Education to bring in education data into this database, not only for the children, but also for the parents as well. So we would be able to get much more fine-tuned information to answer those kinds of questions.
That would have been my third question. Thank you. Stark. Thanks.
Hi. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm looking at your numbers, and my math isn't always accurate, so I'm trying to understand. But so what I'm understanding is 94% mm-hmm. is of the children who had entered into foster or had contact with DHS by their first birthday. And then you went on and said 43% of all children born, you know, had contact with DHS by their first birthday. And then out of that, at age 13, 63% of those 43%.
I went through this pretty quickly, so let me do it one more time. So what we're starting with are all of the children born in the state of Oregon, all of them,
right,
in the year 2001.
So you said roughly 40,000?
Roughly 40,000.
Okay.
Of those, by their first birthday, 43% of them we will find on a DHS or Medicaid program.
Which gives us roughly 17,200.
If
on that map. Okay,
right.
Keep going. I'm making sure I'm tracking.
Now, if I follow those same kids, 13 more years, that same cohort of kids, mm-hmm. by the end of that period, I will have found that 63% of that entire cohort will have touched the Department of Human Services or Medicaid.
63% of that 17,000?
No.
No.
So 63% of the 40,000. Almost two-thirds of the kids born in the year 2001 will have touched a DHS or Medicaid program. Okay. Then, I'm going back to 2001 again, and I'm saying, now I'm only going to look at the 9,500 kids. So, separate analysis. 9,500 kids that were born to mothers who did not graduate from high school. Now I'm going to go out to their 13th birthday and say, of those 9,500 kids, what share of them did I find on DHS and Medicaid? And the answer is 94% of them.
Got it. That helps. Thank you.
I'm going to go to Senator Steiner-Haywood, then I'll come back to you, Ken.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
You don't have your pink on today.
A question. I have the, just so the committee knows, I have the privilege, I've had the privilege for about the past year of serving on the steering committee for this program, which couldn't excite me more. I just love it. But one question I didn't ask at our last meeting that occurs to me now is, are we including birth order data? Like, is a first baby different from a third baby? And do we have any way of figuring out if it's a third baby, are the other two kids still at home, or are they already in foster care, or are we getting even more peeling, or peeling even more of the onion at this point?
So the answer is we have some hazy understanding of that with the data that we have in hand. Again, we have this sort of somewhat artificial time constraint of 2001 to 2010 that cuts off data in front of us and at the end that makes things a little confusing. Also, we did not get the entire vital statistics record. We got a selection of pieces, and I believe there are some record pieces on that vital statistic that would speak to siblings and birth order, but those weren't in the first push of data to us.
We need them.
Representative Kinney-Geyer.
Thank you. I just wanted to follow up on Representative Stark's question about when the 94%. You said something then that shocked me. Now, almost 9,000-something babies were born to women who had not had high school out of the 40,000, so like 22% of all babies born were born to women who did not have a high school degree.
Yeah,
it seems like an extraordinarily high number.
Right, and the denominator for I don't have the 40,000 number crisply in my head, so we can certainly give you that detail. But it is it's a non-trivial share.
Well, and it ties back to the 40-40-20 goals where we have, 65% graduation rate. So maybe I shouldn't be shocked, but I am shocked that nearly a quarter of the babies born have moms that don't have a high school diploma. That's a shocking.
Great connection. Pam,
and I'd like to go back, and I don't know whether you're looking at it or whether it is possible to add the economic impacts. And I would like to go back. You know, we passed the children's plan in 2001. We passed it at a time when the economy in Oregon, and if I can, you know, we were going through an economic downturn, and how much the economy is having to play in the stats, number one. And number two, also some of the other public policy was taking place or had begun to impact Oregon, and that had to do with timber harvest and some of those other issues. Is there a way of capturing, particularly the economic overlay piece? Because as we look at the educational system and the DHS system and some of these things that play into both the educational policy as well as where individuals are ending up, I just can't help but believe that our economy has played a tremendous role in what we're seeing in these stats.
Unequivocally, I couldn't agree more. And think of the 2001 birth cohort. As they're 8 years old, the country is going into one of the deepest recessions in its history, and that continued to go for the next 5 years. So to your point, and again, this is going to be another point where vital stats didn't get us everything that we needed in the first push, we didn't have the geographic placement of the mother's residence at the time of birth, which we will ultimately know. But once we know the geographic location of birth, We could then look at differential entry into DHS and start to look at correlations between that and local economic conditions.
But I think Econ Northwest does have the trends of the of our economy, and
Absolutely.
Actually the trends of our standing nationally mm-hmm. in the average wage, because I can think I remember if I requested that mm-hmm. of where in the 90s before the policy respecting timber, Oregon enjoyed having one of the highest average wages in the country. And I think we can follow those trend lines to determine what's happening to us economically.
Yeah, absolutely.
And, I don't want to get off on that, but if you can add those, I would. Mm-hmm. This is one person would appreciate.
Well, and the other piece in terms of the fiscal consequence of this, again, we have the one chart that shows the costs of the foster care payments and adoptions, et cetera. There are a host of costs that we Oregon Youth Authority, of Department of Corrections, of special education costs, et cetera, that. If this model is made more mature, certainly add to those. This is a pretty limited look at economic costs at this point.
So to continue with John's last point, then we are you. Excuse me. You caught us at a moment in time when we are, or we're here to talk with you at a moment in time when we're partway through the analysis of the data. We have peeled one, or maybe one and a half levels layers of the onion. There are many more yet to come, and we hope to come and share those with you either individually or again in another committee meeting as we continue to sort through this data. But what I've put on the screen now is a website that went live this morning, and. As we have additional data, those data will be placed on this website for public access, and the models ultimately that will be created with those data, the economic predictive model and the predictive model to chart high-risk children and families in the communities in which they live, will be placed on this website as well. So to wrap up, let me just tell you a few things about what comes next. So we also on this website tomorrow will post a request for qualifications to start the capacity building work with a provider community that you asked us to do in order to use this data and to use it to attract outside private sector funds. There's a different business model that's needed at a provider level, and so we've created a request for qualifications that has a needs assessment embedded in it. We will use that to identify interested and potentially ready providers and then be providing them with specific and targeted technical assistance over the next several months to ready them for the business model necessary to contract for outcomes, not for services. So in terms of what's next, excuse me, we'll be working to complete the data analysis. Again, we've showed you just a peek of that today. We'll be adding education and juvenile justice data to that more completed analysis. We will complete the predictive model for high-risk children and communities in Oregon. We will complete the economic model that John showed you a peek at just a few moments ago. We will finalize the interventions review that I indicated was still in process, and we will be identifying and delivering technical assistance to get providers ready. So we anticipate having hot-spotted communities, if you will, having a specific identification of the kinds of kids for whom we could early prevent involvement with child welfare and DHS. We anticipate having an interactive return on investment model for you to see what those avoided costs could be. There is a $5 million allocation in the GRB to allow us to move forward to pilot test both the service and the finance model that we've talked with you about today.
And I'll get right to you, Kenny, and Co-Chair Nathanson. And yes, I would like to talk to you online. And I think we talked briefly about the cross-systems work that's being done by myself and some of the directors. And so, and Co-Chair Nathanson, and then
thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Kenny Guyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, I'm very excited by this model, too. When you talked about targeting hotspots, is that in alignment with the graph you showed us of where the big circles are?
Yeah, co-chairs Representative Kinnegar. Yes, that's right.
Thank you.
Co-chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, I have something I'd like to talk about with regard to pay for prevention, not only this policy option package, but there are several others they're going to describe. Can you give me an idea of how much time you want to spend on this presentation? Should I ask questions now?
I think you ask questions. You know, actually, I don't know close you are to wrapping up?
We are finished. This is our last slide.
Okay. Then I think you can ask questions of,
thank you,
of Ms. Curtis.
Well, first of all, I want to say, who wouldn't be impressed by this work? It seems like at least most, if not all of us, are very impressed with the wealth of data that you have analyzed and the additional analysis that you have then prepared to present to us. It's really terrific work. So here comes the ways and means, but here's the wet blanket part. What we're learning is what we suspected. This data, I think, it does an excellent job of confirming what most people with some reasonable thinking skills knew was going on, that when there's maltreatment at an early age, you pay a lot for it later. And you are giving us now the statistical data that confirms it and explains exactly how much it costs us. Oregon is not a wealthy state. For weeks, week after week, we hear in testimony, Oregon is 46th in the nation in investing on this, or 47th in the nation in investing on that, or 46th or 47th in the nation in outcomes, or number of days in school for children. I mean, it's just, you know, one point after another. And so part of me is wondering, at what point do we say, when we are not a wealthy state, are we spending a lot of money on a think tank that's going to produce absolutely excellent research, and at what point do we start spending the money on the investment? So I'm going to need to be convinced that we need to keep paying for analysis and data, rather than can we just put $5 million directly into helping kids now? That's the case that I have to have made.
John and I are going to double team this.
Okay. And you probably knew that was coming.
So in an era of scarce resources, it's imperative that you spend them as wisely as possible. And I think a very valid question right out of this gate is, if you had some money to spend on a program, where would you spend it? And I think the information that we're starting to develop out of this database would not only be helpful for this particular demonstration, but if I were running the Department of Human Services, if I were running any field office in the state of Oregon that has to do with preventing child maltreatment, I would be tripping over myself to get this information so I'd know exactly with which families I want to prevent, with the very limited, far too limited resources that I have to spend on it.
The other piece I would add to that, Representative Nathanson and co-chairs, or co-chair Rep. Nathanson, is that the $5 million that's asked for, just to clarify, in the GRB is not to continue the data analysis. The $800,000 you gave us was to do the data analysis so that we could do a much better job of targeting, to John's point, exactly which children and families and communities, and then to use that $5 million to attract upfront private sector investments, which essentially grows your ability to do preventative investment. Right now, having not sat in your seat or been in a decision maker role for a long time, I remember, though, the struggle about how do you find the money to invest in prevention, because you're having to take it away from services that you're already delivering. What this model does is give you the opportunity to invest in prevention without upfront investment other than this $5 million from the legislature, from the general fund. And then that $5 million is used to pay back private sector investment that funds the upfront services, and it's only paid back when specific outcomes are achieved. So it creates an opportunity for you to grow your resources for investment.
Madam Chair, thank you. So $5 million is an investment. It's leveraging other money. That's what I'm hearing. The words I see on the screen, though, complete predictive model, complete economic model, finalize evidence review, implement a finance and service model. What I'm seeing is a lot of stuff that we do, that you all do, sitting behind desks, it's not helping the kids and the families who are in our communities. So that begs the question for me, because we are still struggling to find places to trim our budget. Is this more important than existing services? Do we make even deeper cuts to seniors and persons with disabilities and children and struggling families? Do we cut even deeper in existing programs to carve out this $5 million? And that's what dilemma. We have to figure out.
Madam Chair, I've been given the hook by our staff here. And so is it possible either to return or to talk offline?
It is possible, co-chairs, to do both. And I will apologize for the bottom line. It's a misnomer. The $5 million is for services going forward. All of the bullets until then are work that we are completing with the $800,000.
Thank you.
So I apologize.
Much.
That's my problem.
Thank
on this
you.
Slide.
That's a big help.
I would suggest there's a lot of interest in this, that perhaps we should have them return to give us more clarity and information.
We'd be pleased to do so. Thank you.
Thank you.
And
I'm going to stay out for just a moment.
Sure. Ms. Day.
Co-chair Winters, co-chair Nathanson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Lois Day. I'm the director for child welfare in the Department of Human Services. The next two policy option packages relate to the child welfare program. And Director Kelly Seal said we went through a process and made decisions around why to prioritize these particular options. And so I wanted to speak to that for a minute. In child welfare, as you all are aware, we're undergoing a number of initiatives, all focused on safely and equitably reducing the number of children who experience foster care and leaving their families strengthened in a way that they can keep their children safe at home and not come back to our system. These two policy option packages help us move those initiatives forward at the rate of speed we are currently operating. This first POP is a position to increase our ability to do file reviews. The federal government requires us to go through a process of what's called a child and family services review on periodic basis, and that consists of in-depth file reviews, stakeholder interviews, and scoring, interviews within the building as well, and then scoring where we hit on different outcomes that the federal government requires. That review for us is occurring in 2016. A difference this year, or this round of reviews for us, is that the federal government has offered states the opportunity to do their own review, which will allow us to create some flexibility, but you have to have a quality assurance program that's at a level that they believe is sufficient to conduct the review without them being on site. This additional file reviewer will supplement the ones we have and allow us to get to the stakeholder interviews, which we've not been able to get to because of resources, and actually lays the foundation for an ongoing continuous quality improvement system, quality assurance system for child welfare that will continue even after our federal review. That's important to us because when the federal reviews occur, they tell us those areas where we don't meet the federal standard, and you have to create what's called a program improvement plan, and then they come back later to see if your program improvement plan has actually raised those areas where you said you needed to do improvement. This increase in our case reviewers will allow us to do that continuous look at those areas where we need to improve to see how we're doing with our program improvement plan, and it will allow us to continuously look at those areas where we met the federal mark to ensure we stay there and don't slip. So that's the first package. The second one is called program infrastructure. The way the child welfare program within the Department of Human Services is designed is we have field-delivered services, and through central office, we have staff that trains, coaches, consults, provides support for the adaptive changes we're asking in the field, and does another form of quality assurance. And they're based primarily geographically out in the field, but they are managed through our central office design group. In 2013, field positions were increased to address our workload and also increase readiness for the implementation of differential response, and that was a wonderful thing, and we appreciated that staff. But as the field staff has grown, these staff available to support the field staff have remained static. So we're bringing forward this package in hopes of increasing those staff that provide those supports so that we can keep the various initiatives going at the rate of speed that we're currently doing them. And that includes the implementation of the Title IV demonstration waiver, continued implementation of differential response, permanency roundtables, investigating whether or not we should have a statewide hotline, additional supports for provider payments.
Lois, quick question. With differential response, have you seen, is it too early to determine whether or not the foster home utilization is actually reducing? And if so, what impact does that have on when we start talking about field staff and support staff?
Co-chair Winters, differential response has been in three Oregon counties for almost a year, and this month we implemented in three additional counties and will, by the end of the month, implement in a fourth county. So we don't have, we haven't had adequate time for differential response to tell, to show us the impact it's having on our foster care population. I can say that in federal fiscal year 2014, we had an 8.4% reduction in our foster care population. We think it's our belief, and there's evidence that indicates around the country that with full implementation of differential response, we will have additional reduction in foster care, and we will have a reduction in our disproportionate representation of children of color in our system. But we simply haven't had enough counties online or enough time doing this practice to have those results yet.
When do you anticipate that you'll be able to reach some substantial benchmarks?
We have the full implementation schedule has us completing implementation in 2017. We have engaged the evaluator for our differential response system, and they are beginning the process of looking at those initial counties. They'll be using those initial three counties plus these additional four that we're adding this year as the counties to look for the results and then comparing them in the counties that we'll be implementing later. So I believe in this biennium, by the end of this biennium coming up, we should have some information that indicates to us what is it actually doing and is it doing what we anticipate.
Hey, Madam Chair, I've been involved with the group down in Lynn Benton, and I think Lois is Lincoln County too. And the most recent group that just entered into this, and I think initially our meetings there was some skepticism, and as we've progressed toward it, I mean, there's been really some big interest and excitement about moving forward with this. So
I think it's the hope that at some point, rather than the request for additional staff, we should at some point, if things are being successful and we're not having extraordinary population growth, that we should begin to see some declines. So go ahead, Lois.
Thank you, Co-Chair Winters, Co-Chair Nathan, some members of the committee. That is my presentation, so if you have additional questions, I can take those, and if not, I'll allow us to move on to vocational rehabilitation.
Okay. Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Trina Lee, and I am the Interim Director for Vocational Rehabilitation with the Department of Human Services. Thank you, co-chairs and the committee today. I just want to remind everyone that we were here in front of this committee not too terribly long ago, and we went into some great depth about our program, and so there's a lot of good information that I'll try to highlight just briefly, because I know I want to keep us on time. But just know that you have some information that was presented to you earlier. The first policy option package that we're going to discuss today, you'll notice that this is actually just a shift in funding, in the sense that we are This is a budget-neutral request, but it's our opportunity to be able to shift individuals that have currently been hitting certain expenses over to personal services. And these individuals that we're talking about, these 19 staff, are completely all the way through our service delivery system and also within our central supports for design and operations. So it's both central office staff and field staff in total. So let me pause really quick, see if there's any questions about this one before I move on. So the next policy option package goes into a little bit more detail, and this is asking for position authority for vocational rehabilitation for 11 staff. And the first are 6 vocational rehabilitation counselors that focused upon the intellectual and developmental disabilities population. Last biennium, you afforded us the opportunity to have the first of the series of these individuals go out into the community, and this is just rounding that out. So then we'll have a representative that focuses upon the IDD population in every branch office. We anticipate that there'll be some very specific outcomes from these individuals. Obviously, we'll be, as I just mentioned, in each of the branches. Plus, we see that just as a real rough estimate, we'll be able to serve an additional 400 to 500 individuals with intellectual and developmental disabilities across the state, which then will in turn increase our rehabilitations and assist us in meeting our benchmark requirements with Executive Order 1501. The other is, as staff attached, there's 2 different areas. The next one is the Youth Transition Program, which is 3 staff in total, and these individuals will be in our program design and operation. And this is to assist our Youth Transition Program. Currently, we have 105 school districts that we're in, which covers about 120 high schools across the state, which is, in point of reference, about 2/3 of the school districts. We are currently taking applications to increase that, and as of yesterday, we have 17 applications to branch out into other areas that we've not been in before, including the Portland metro area. Some of the outcomes that we can expect. Obviously, we'll be assisting the new schools, in the implementation of this project and program. Will also assist us in the 5 basic enhanced activities through the pre-employment transition services with, really quickly, I'll run through them, job exploration and counseling, work-based learning experiences, counseling on opportunities for enrollment in comprehensive transition or post-secondary education, workplace readiness training, and instruction on self-advocacy. Additionally, this is one of our key ways that we're going to be able to help identify and address the new requirements that are listed actually for the Workforce Innovation and Opportunity Act, WIOA. Today, the proposed rules are being published. We got an advanced copy of them about 10 days ago. There's about 1,250 pages of new proposed regulations that we're starting to weed through. So we have a lot of work ahead of us. To wrap up,
question on the Workforce Innovation Opportunity Grants, are you hearing from any of the quote sheltered workshops and others some concern as to whether or not they may or may not be able to continue to be provide those services because of the new rulings that's coming down?
Let's see. So, Co-Chair Winters, I actually probably can defer some of that question over to Lily Attenity, who's the Director of Developmental Disabilities, Intellectual Developmental Program. But real quickly before I do that, again, the rules just hit the streets today, and we definitely have targeted populations that we need to serve and whatnot. So we're still trying to identify exactly what that all means and exactly what that means for us in Oregon.
For the record, my name is Lily Attenity. I'm the Director for the Office of Developmental Disabilities Services within DHS. Co-chairs, Committee and Senator Winters. The issue around sheltered workshops and WIOA regulations specifically, the tie there is really through VR. I think Specifically, what you might be speaking to is the Employment First Initiative that the governor's executive order put in place in 2013, as well as the division and the Employment First Initiative group's response in trying to work with people with intellectual and developmental disabilities to help them identify and transition into integrated employment settings. All of that work is being done under the goals of the Employment First Initiative and under the with the understanding of the lawsuit that we are currently engaged in with the U.S. Department of Justice, which has stated or which alleges that the state of Oregon is violating the rights of people with intellectual and developmental disabilities by not allowing them to fully pursue integrated employment. And we've been working very hard for many years on initiatives to move in that direction. One of them is through the Employment First transformation grants that many providers are participating in. In terms of federal regulation and its connection at this point to the sheltered workshop settings as well, I presented to the Ways and Means Committee earlier this session on the home and community-based settings regulations that have recently come out from the Center for Medicaid and Medicare Services. We expect that as part of our efforts with that, we'll be working with sheltered workshop providers to transform and to really move in the direction of providing integrated services.
I understand the issue.
Mm-hmm.
My question is whether you have heard from any of the providers that caused them some discomfort as to whether they will continue to provide those services that we currently have because of the federal regulations that have come down.
Co-Chair Winters, yes, we are talking to providers, and definitely there are providers who are concerned about what's going to happen with them and their services in the future as a result of everything that is occurring.
And have any of them given the indication that there is a probability that they may not continue to provide service? Because if that happens, we have to have a plan B.
Co-Chair Senator Winters, yes. We are talking to our provider groups and provider agencies, and yes, that's one of the things that we're looking at, and the reasons for the transformation grants and some of the things even in this POP continue that effort to work with providers and work to help them move forward in figuring out ways to support people in a way that will be support integrated employment for individuals with intellectual and developmental disabilities. So definitely that's part of the difficult process involved in this. Is really working with not only individuals and their families, but also working with providers to help them move in this direction as well.
Okay. Continue.
Thank you. So just real briefly, co-chairs and the members of the committee, just reminding folks in federal fiscal year 2014, vocational rehabilitation served right at 3,500 youth. And so obviously with this additional investment, we would see those numbers increase. With the WIOA standards, just to kind of almost touch a little bit of your question, Senator Winters, too, we will have new benchmarks as to when a person has been placed and looking at the second and the fourth quarter after that placement to see about sustainability. We do know about that. We're trying to figure out how we're going to accomplish that with our employment partners as well. And additionally, as I'd mentioned in the previous presentation, we have reduced our amount of time to get individuals into plan. And this is not just individuals with IDD, but this is all individuals that vocational rehabilitation serves. So there has been, some significant changes that we've made in our service delivery system. And the last portion of this policy option package is to assist with the Work Incentives Network, we call it WIN. And there are a couple of permanent positions being requested that would be housed within our program design and implementation. And their scope would really be to train and oversee and support the counselors out in the field that plan future delivery of services. So the If you remember, I had a conversation in regards to the Centers for Independent Living, and some of the services that the centers provide includes the work incentive networks, where there are counselors in those centers to be able to assist individuals as they're trying to determine what will happen if they go to work, what will happen with their Social Security benefits. Now, this committee also recognized that there's not centers in every county. However, this one program is statewide, and so even though we may not have a center in the area, the centers assist to cover the other counties that a center does not exist. As of yesterday, we took a look at how many people are in the queue waiting for these services, and as of yesterday, there was 137 individuals across the state of Oregon who were waiting to be able to obtain the services, but they just haven't got there yet. And so the additional monies would assist in assisting these contracted services through the benefit counselors to be able to serve these individuals. Plus, the other added thing is currently only individuals that are VR clients can access these services. So this policy option package would open that up to where you wouldn't have to be a VR client. You could be just an individual with disability and obtain those services of what's going to happen with your benefits. And the research has shown that, you know, individuals with informed choice, it really makes a big difference. And it's a true counseling service where if I go in and start to have a job, and I'm making this up, at 10 hours a week, and then I want to see what's going to happen to my benefits at 15 or 20 hours a week, then I have a person to go in and help me walk through that process, because it is very detailed and a real challenging effort to follow it on our own. So let me pause really quickly and see if there's any additional questions before I turn this over to Lilia for the next policy option package.
Only that, since it's not a really policy change, it's a position change, a position addition. Can that be handled with transfers from someplace else into your unit?
Thank you, Co-Chair Senator Winders. To be honest with you, our entire field structure for vocational rehabilitation, we have 250 staff, and we serve a right at 15,000 Oregonians. So we, you know, we're a very small program in comparison, so the answer at this point is no.
I'm not necessarily talking about your particular department, but go ahead.
Okay. And finally, as the slide indicates, if not funded, you know, what will happen? Obviously, it will be harder to achieve the benchmarks that have been set forth for us in the executive order, but also we have this looming conversation that if we are not able to serve all the individuals and not have the money to serve all individuals, then we would potentially go back into a waiting list under the order selection. So I just wanted to round that out as to the whys if we're not able to be funded. So thank you for your opportunity, and I'll turn this over to Lilia.
How many other states are under order, or possibly under order selections?
I do not know the exact, Co-Chair Winters, I would need to get back with you with that specific information. I do not know the exact number today, but I can provide that.
Okay. Thank you, Co-Chairs and Committee. I'll move on and start talking about the other POPs related to the intellectual and developmental disabilities programs within DHS. The first one relates to building capacity within our private provider community to help with the transition of individuals from our Stabilization and Crisis Unit, or SACU. SACU is shifting its service system delivery model to one of being short-term crisis supports for individuals with significant behavioral challenges. A number of these individuals are duly diagnosed. They have both intellectual and developmental disability and co-occurring mental health issues, and we are finding that they are the ones that we right now within the SACU and within the state as overall need significant amounts of support. And so we are shifting the model at the SACU to provide short-term stabilization and support for those individuals. As part of this effort,
question is, your stakeholders, both from the private side as well as SEIU, active participant in this discussion?
Co-chair and Senator Winters, absolutely. The represented group at SAC was with AFSCME, and they are definitely involved in this discussion. As everyone knows, I think we're in collective bargaining with them right now, and so, and this process has been going on for some time, and they're aware and have been involved in that process.
My second question, because the issue of a private provider with this particular population group has been of discussion in this building since 1999, just so you know.
Okay.
And around that issue is whether or not on the private side there is actually the capacity on a 24/7 basis to actually handle this particular group, particularly since when on their side and a crisis occur, it is the state group that actually is the safety net. So is this part of the conversation?
Co-chair and Senator Winters, yes, definitely it is. This is, quite frankly, that particular issue is a big part of the reason for this discussion. We have people at SACU. There are about 106 to 107 individuals who live there on a regular basis. Of those, we've got 16 right now who have the goal of transitioning to a community-based agency or community-based provider within their individual support plan. They're actively working on that. They're stabilized. They're ready to transition. We've got about 42 other individuals who are as stable as they are going to be, basically, but for their disability, they would be not be at SACU. They had something occur that was a crisis situation that came to SACU. They're where they're going to be at in terms of support, and now we're looking for, through this POP, to encourage community providers to work with us to identify and create placements for them in the community. We think that they can transition and be supported in the community. What that does is that allows us to free up beds within the SACU system to take other individuals who may be coming out of Oregon State Hospital or from jail or from community providers where they're not able to be supported effectively in the moment when they're in crisis.
I'd like additional offline conversation.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Chair, I'd love to join you at some point for that. I've had some conversations over the last year. I'm very interested in this subject.
Yeah, it's been a subject that's been discussed in this building, like I said earlier, since 99, and it goes back to the closure of Fairview. And that closure in 99 and a part of the agreements that were reached was that there would be a place that's not in the community, that is actually controlled and managed by the state for this population that could not, for a variety of reasons, go back into community settings. And some of the individuals in this group are extremely violent with both medical as well as other problems. And so I just want to make certain that we're headed down the right path.
Thank you, Co-Chair Senator Winters. And there are many discussions right now, I'm sure you all are aware, going on related to SACU and supports provided there. One of the things that will be occurring is there is a bill related to a task force to address these issues as well. So I'd be happy to meet with both of you and whoever else might be interested to discuss that further.
As I understand, the request from AFSCME was that request was actually additional staff. Not so much of taking and having a crisis unit, but additional staff to handle the in-resident crisis that exists. Am I not correct?
That is part of the discussion, is the transition of individuals out and then the how we will use additional staff that may come about as a result of either collective bargaining or other activities. Thank you. Moving on to the next POP for the Office of Developmental Disability Services. This one is specific to a 4% provider rate increase to all IDDD providers who provide non-bargain services. This POP estimates the financial for this POP indicates that it would go into effect on January 1st of 2016. I know there's been a lot of advocacy from various groups within the legislature around the need for increases, rate increases, and we're doing this in response to the fact that we understand the needs of our provider community. We're proposing it because we know they have high rate of staff turnover. They've not had a significant rate. They've had significant rate rejections due to the past economic environment, and have not had a cost of living allowance in three biennia. This will allow these agencies to increase direct staff wages and benefits for those for serving people with intellectual and developmental disabilities. And really, one of the challenges that we're seeing now, it's been good that the K plan or Community First Choice option has expanded services to a number of people. It's increased our number of personal support workers that are represented through SEIU, and it's created competition for direct support professional positions in a way that didn't really exist as significantly before. And so we understand that our providers are faced with some challenges right now. And these are providers that provide 24-hour group home settings. They also do something called supported living. These are our kids' foster care, children's residential, and employment service providers are the providers that would be able to access or benefit from this 4% rate increase. If we are not able to do this, they will continue to face challenges providing competitive wages to their staff, and we would have, as a state, ultimately continue to have concerns around quality and what's happening in those settings if cost of living continues to go up and we're not able to help our providers meet those costs. Any questions related to this pop?
Yes.
Could you just tell us what the salary ranges are for the basic positions? Are they all direct support?
This is a 4% rate increase, and what that is, we have rate models, and within our rate models, we estimate we use a $12.94 wage for group home providers for their direct support professionals. For employment and all of the other supported living and all the other types of providers, the wage we use is $10.80 in our rate models. And so the rates that providers are paid, that's the wage that the rate is driven off of. And so what this increase would do would just increase the rate by 4%.
This is very low.
Extremely.
Any additional questions?
No, I just think you just got a real pause from the panel.
Mm-hmm. I think so, too.
Co-Chair Nathanson.
So 4%, I have a little calculator on my computer, but what 4% increases it from 1080 to...
Oh, I used to have this memory, 11 something, if I recall correctly. I can get you that very quickly as soon as I go back and use my phone calculator.
But I'm going to ask Ms. Byerly to
Madam Co-Chair and Madam Co-Chair. Just for clarification, that I want to make it real clear that what Leah's talking about is increasing the rate that a provider receives for serving a client.
Yes.
So that rate amount will increase by 4%.
Yes.
That may or may not translate into a 4% wage increase for an employee.
Correct.
Because the department's this models that include a wage analysis doesn't necessarily mean the provider is paying that wage. And part of what you're hearing from constituents is that they want to have their wages increased. And I just want you to understand that an increase in the rate does not directly translate into that same increase in the wage paid to an employee.
So follow up. Thank you, Madam Chair.
I have
mentioned in the past that one of the techniques I'm interested in looking at is asking the department if there's a way to prepare contracts with providers that ensures that all or a significant part of that increase goes to wages.
Co-chairs, Representative Nathan, we had a presentation by RTI, which was part of an effort, I think, as a result of a budget known the last biennium. We've looked at their data, and in terms of putting something into a contract, that is something we could discuss. I think I appreciate the clarification that this doesn't necessarily, the rate increase is a rate increase, and we don't, as the state, we don't get involved directly in the wages that our providers have with their employees. Some of our providers are collectively bargained within their own private agencies, and there's just a number of issues related to that. So in terms of what type of language we would put in the contract and how strong it would be, I think that would need to be something we would talk with our legal Department of Justice about, but I know that is a discussion that's been happening, and we we can continue to talk about that, or in terms of how we do that.
The co-chair asked my question. Thank you.
Representative Boone.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I just, topping off what Nancy says, I think that if we're going to call it a COLA, it should be a COLA, and then therefore it should be attached to that person's wage. Otherwise, we could just call it an increase to the contract. But I think if you start taking away, and I'm very well aware of Ways and Means proclivity to sweeping things, it kind of starts to fall into that thought process.
Could you provide us with the turnover rate data that I'm sure you probably have on your facilities, which tells us a lot about how successful, based on wage structures, that the provider is at retaining their employees?
Yes, I can go back and do that. Thank you.
You have one more.
Oh, I have one more? Oh, yes, I do. I'm sorry. I thought I went, whew. Thank you. The last slide here is not specifically a POP, it's a package. It just speaks to the fact that as part of the introduced budget, the Fairview Trust, which was established with the closure of Fairview in 1999, would be depleted. And ultimately, with the service increases in the DD system and other things that are occurring, the funding for that is part of what the DD budget has been based on in the governor's introduced budget. I know there's been, again, this is another issue where other discussions are occurring, and a lot of advocacy has occurred around the Fairview Trust. I think that this is definitely a unique thing to Oregon, that this trust was established to honor a commitment to people who with intellectual and developmental disabilities. And this is one that, honestly, I've struggled with a little bit, because last biennium, I would say, with the implementation of the Community First Choice option, Oregon made a new promise for people with intellectual and developmental disabilities, and that is to serve anyone who's eligible based on their functional needs. And that's been the basis behind a lot of our that is the reason for our significant caseload increase, not only this biennium, but projected next biennium. So this is a challenging issue, and we wanted to note it here as part of the budget that is what is in the governor's introduced budget.
It's just getting your money back.
Any additional questions? All right, thank you very much.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, for the record, Mike McCormick, director of the Aging and People with Disabilities Program within DHS. So you may recall on February 16th, I gave an extensive presentation on the Department of Labor regulations and their impact on the Department of Human Services, significantly to both the APD program and the IDD program. To refresh everyone's memory, all of the regulations are currently in litigation, and we don't anticipate any certainty on that litigation until late summer or early fall. To prepare, the department has continued to work to position Oregon in the event that the Department of Labor wins its appeal. So the programmatic changes that we're proceeding on at this time. Yes.
Is Oregon alone in the challenge, or are there other states?
Co-chair Winters, my belief is all 50 states are impacted by this regulation.
So it's where all 50 states have decided to get on their hindquarters and say, we're not taking it. Mm-hmm. I'm just being very candid and upfront is what's happening across the country.
There are significant advocacy efforts going on by a variety of parties.
Very diplomatic.
So what we're doing to prepare ourselves at this time is we're working with a very large stakeholder community, you know, to limit the amount of hours that home care workers can work each week, and to restrict which consumers have access to our live-in program. All consumers will continue to have access to services. It'll just be under a slightly different model. And so, you know, at this point, we still think it's prudent in light of the current litigation, to appropriate money towards this effort. And of course, the department would be willing to report back on the litigation efforts and any firmed up fiscal impact numbers associated with this regulation.
Can I ask you another question? And I know that you're looking at the agency's rules, which is being challenged. Does it also appear that now that Congress has changed, as far as part, if that's also going to be a policy change politically?
Co-chair Winters, I'm not aware of the specific efforts that are being undertaken by the Republican Congress on this issue.
Questions?
All right, the next policy option package. So as part of the senior special purpose appropriation, there was a recognition by both the legislature and the advocate community that DHS needs a lot of work in how it's managing its data around adult protective services. So there was an investment to do a study for a replacement adult protective service system that combined, I think it's 7 or 9 separate APS systems into one and develop a business case. And, you know, that work is complete, and the department prepared a policy option package in response to that report.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Sarah Miller. I'm the Department of Human Services COO for Technology, and I'm here to speak to the specifics of the IT system recommendation. I apologize for my voice. I am just out of bed from a high fever, so forgive me. But the work that the department has undertaken, both with our IT service provider, the Office of Information Services, and using external vendors, has been to help us plan for this work. As you all know, State CIO Dr. Alex Pettit has implemented a new stage gate process, which requires the production of certain kinds of planning information before technology investments can move forward. Foundational to that work is a business case, which the department has recently completed a draft of using a third-party consultant, RADA Consulting, to prepare. I think the need for this investment is well known. You've had many hearings that talk about how difficult it is for us to gather information centrally. We're still in the review process on our business case and have not yet submitted it to the state CIO's office because it hasn't gone all the way through the department's vetting system. But certainly the department remains committed to following that stage gate process and ask the body to support this investment so that we can make sure that our most vulnerable adults have a mechanism to understand how their care is so that we can provide better oversight in the future. And so certainly those people remain at risk if this investment isn't made. It's a combination of general fund and Q bond funding to support the project on the go forward.
No questions?
The last POP is in support of the non-MAGI eligibility for Medicaid. So let's do some definitions, right? MAGI is modified adjusted gross income. That is the federal Medicaid rule that provides Medicaid solely on the basis of income. There are other types of Medicaid for aged, blind, disabled populations. We generally call those non-MAGI Medicaid services. The state, as you all know, because I was here last Thursday talking to you about it, is undergoing a system transfer project right now to implement MAGI Medicaid eligibility determination in Oregon. The Oregon Health Authority has elected to implement the Commonwealth of Kentucky's MAGI Medicaid system. In the fall of this year, CMS extended 90-10 enhanced funding for Medicaid state eligibility systems. And so when the Department of Human Services looked at what system it made most sense to proceed with in terms of advancing investments in our legacy systems, non-MAGI eligibility immediately floated to the top because of the potential to get enhanced funding. And so POP 103 includes money for initial planning and initial implementation of a eligibility system. We will begin this planning work with current resources in the current biennia so that if you make this investment, we are able to proceed immediately with actioning on this at the biennial change. This is a combination of general fund 10% and federal fund at 90%. We have received approval on behalf of the department from the Center for Medicaid and Medicare Services for $6.75 million in federal fiscal year 15. And so we are advocating that as soon as we finish the MAGI implementation, we should begin working for planning for non-MAGI eligibility system replacement.
Ms. Erin Kelly-Seals.
Thank you. I just wanted to say that we will be back Monday to finish out the other program areas, self-sufficiency, and then also some of our policy packages that touch other parts of the agency, central and shared services. I did want to make note, too, that we took the – you have a large document that includes the entirety of our budget, and that what we tried to do in preparation for today, because we know there are a lot – this is a high-level overview of a lot of detailed information. You should have electronically a collection of the policy packages that actually were in the governor's budget so that you could leaf through and see in more detail very rapidly by referencing back to the slides the number and the policy packages and the details that support them. So we just appreciate the time to talk about what is in the budget, and we look forward to more time with you on Monday.
Questions? Thank you very much. And, Lori, do you have anything to add?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
With that, we are on time. I'm not going to say on budget. We are adjourned. We are adjourned. Budget.